The leader of ISIS is dead following a U.S. military operation.
This is a significant development. I would say that Baghdadi's death is the most important thing that has happened in the terrorism field since the death of Osama bin Laden.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for October 28th, we'll look into the implications of his death as the United States walks back its presence in the Middle East. Plus, the first major climate change lawsuit to reach trial in the United States is underway, and it could establish an important precedent going forward.
There's more than a dozen lawsuits now pending against Exxon and other major fossil fuel companies, trying to get them to help pay the costs. And there's no doubt that what happens in this suit will be cited in all of those that come.
And Disney is set to launch its new streaming service next month, but the offensive Song of the South won't be on the platform. We begin with al-Baghdadi's demise. Let's get started.
The United States brought the world's number one terrorist leader to justice.
We have breaking news that ISIS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi is believed to have been killed
after a raid by American troops in Syria.
Al-Baghdadi was the founder of ISIS. He formed the caliphate.
The group likely has very clear succession mechanisms.
It's great that we've gotten al-Baghdadi and killed him. He's a dangerous man, an evil man. The fight against ISIS has to continue.
Many of his adherents who are now in prison camps guarded by Kurds might well be able to escape at the moment because the Kurds are too busy coping with the Turks.
These savage monsters will not escape their fate, and they will not escape the final judgment of God.
It's really unprecedented when you think about how much detail he actually went into.
So our dogs chased him down. He ignited his vest, killing himself and the three children.
Had this escalated, had something gone wrong, it's to the administration's advantage to be able to say, we informed Congress we were going in, they were aware of the risks.
This country will be unrelenting in our fight against ISIS or any terrorist organization.
Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi is dead.
On Sunday morning, President Trump announced that the leader of the Islamic State was killed during a U.S. military operation at a compound in northwestern Syria. Al-Baghdadi had evaded capture for more than a decade. In graphic detail, Trump described the operation:
dangerous and daring nighttime raid.
Recounting the last moments of al-Baghdadi's life.
Whimpering and crying and screaming all the way.
Cornered in a tunnel.
And he died in a vicious and violent way as a coward, running and crying.
The ISIS leader detonated a suicide vest, killing himself and three children. With its eye on forming a global caliphate, ISIS differentiated itself from other terrorist organizations by its brutality and violence under al-Baghdadi's leadership, including the rape of women and girls and the deaths of many Western hostages. Joining me now are Rukmini Kalamaki, the terrorism correspondent for The New York Times, who's been covering ISIS for more than 5 years. Rukmini, thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
We're also joined by Brian Stelter, host of Reliable Sources and CNN's chief media correspondent. Brian, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Rukmini, let's start with you. The significance of al-Baghdadi's death, what should we make of it? Is this more of a victory for the United States or a defeat of ISIS?
This is a significant development. I would say that Baghdadi's death is the most important thing that has happened in the terrorism field since the death of Osama bin Laden. Baghdadi's significance is that he had created a kind of cult of personality around himself, whereby people who carried out attacks in his name, both those who were directed by ISIS to do so and those who were merely inspired to, would pledge allegiance to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. They would issue a video, a handwritten message, an audio recording, specifically pledging fealty to him and to him alone before carrying out those acts. So for that reason, and because of the fact that he was, of course, the overall leader of the Islamic State, I do think that this is a significant blow. However, I don't think it should be overstated. This is a group that has lost its leaders in the past and that has previously succeeded in regenerating itself despite those losses.
Brian, given Rukmini's comments there about how significant this is, President Trump appeared very eager to claim credit for the raid this weekend. How is Trump framing al-Baghdadi's death?
This was a man who really wanted to talk and keep talking. You know, this is why he held a nearly hour-long address to the nation that became a Q&A session, where he sometimes strayed from the facts and exaggerated his own abilities. You know, I think it was striking that the president went into such graphic, violent detail, telling a story the way he oftentimes tells stories at his rallies. You know, it almost moved into that sort of zone. I think this is one of those, you know, dividing lines where if you're a Trump supporter, you loved hearing him talk about this vicious terrorist crying in a hole. If you're against the president, then you think this was probably inappropriate and you wonder if he was even telling the truth. And frankly, unfortunately, that's an open question, whether some of those details will actually check out or not.
Rukmini, one of the things that President Trump mentioned in that press conference, he named Turkey, Russia, Iraq, and Syria as allies. What do we know about the veracity of those claims and about those alliances so far?
We know for sure that the Kurds provided important intelligence that helped us get Baghdadi. That's a bit ironic in light of the fact that the United States has essentially betrayed the Kurds in the last couple of weeks by giving a green light to Turkey to invade their territory in northern Syria. In addition, the Iraqis were crucial in providing information and cross-referencing the data that was given. Regarding Turkey and Russia, I am skeptical of those claims, and I think it's important to note that Baghdadi was discovered in an area that was just a few miles from the Turkish border. And according to my sources, his whereabouts in Idlib were confirmed as far back as July. So for several months, he was in an area that was very close to another NATO member, Turkey. And it seems to be an open question to me as to whether they knew of his whereabouts there.
And of course, you mentioned earlier, Rukmini, that a lot of experts are saying, including yourself, that eliminating the leader of a terrorist organization, while significant, may not actually eliminate the threat here. We saw in the aftermath of Osama bin Laden's death that al-Qaeda continued to grow. What's your sense for what may happen to ISIS now that al-Baghdadi is dead?
The first question is a question of succession. It's unclear who is the person that is going to take over from Baghdadi in the wake of his death. When Osama bin Laden was killed, there was a clear number two, Ayman Zawahiri, and he took over immediately after bin Laden's death. That path of succession is not so clear here. And the one thing to keep in mind is that unlike bin Laden, and really unlike any other terrorist leader before him, Baghdadi claimed to be not just the head of a terrorist organization, he claimed to be the caliph of the Islamic State, the caliph of a caliphate. And according to their own rules and their reading of scripture, in order to be a caliph, you need to show an ancestry that traces back to the Quraysh tribe. This is the tribe of the Prophet Muhammad. Not a lot of people have that particular ancestry. So the pool of people that can be chosen, if that next person intends to also be a caliph of this imagined caliphate, that pool of people is small.
Brian, we talked a little bit about the announcement itself, the length of the announcement, but this happened on a Sunday morning at, you know, 9 a.m., 9:15 a.m. It was preceded by a cryptic tweet the night before saying that some news would be coming. And as we're talking here about bin Laden, I can't help but think back to the way the announcement of bin Laden's death was made in the media. How do you compare that to what we saw yesterday?
You know, I think in some ways the president was overcompensating because he wants this to be viewed as a bigger victory for the United States than the bin Laden assassination. I don't know how it could possibly be viewed that way, but that's how the president wants it to be seen. You know, bin Laden was always far more familiar and more fearsome in the minds of Americans. And I think that there was a resulting difference in the reactions on Sunday versus the reactions to the death of bin Laden. But as Rukmini says, this is the most significant event since the death of bin Laden. So I'm not trying to undersell it. I think it's just that the president was trying to perhaps over-dramatize what happened in order to impress the American audience and an audience around the world. You know, he went out there with what the Washington Post said was a 900-word speech. He ended up saying about 8,000 words. It was good to see him answering questions and providing more information. But as always with this president, you do wonder about how much he's exaggerating or trying to oversell his own stories. And I think it's going to take days to find out more about that background. And of course, the other context here is the impeachment inquiry. You know, this is the highs and the lows of the Trump presidency, where it's pretty clear now impeachment is inevitable in the House. Then the president announces this incredible U.S. military victory, and yet all the alleged abuses of power that were being investigated 2 days ago are still just as relevant today. I think that's the box the president finds himself in.
Curious to ask to get both of your thoughts. Brian, I'll get you, and then Rukmini, I'd like to hear from you, because generally when we see a president make these announcements, including what happened with Osama bin Laden, it's the president, he comes out, he addresses the nation, and then you may see a subsequent address by military leaders, by White House press corps, you know, who are taking questions more formally. Right. That didn't happen here. The president was basically left on his own, as you said, from a 900-word speech to an 8,000-word press conference, and he felt pretty unprepared or just kind of freewheeling. So, Brian, I'm curious to hear your thoughts. Well,
certainly, the only thing that we saw follow up afterwards was from Defense Secretary Mark Esper, who gave a few interviews, and in the interviews, he acknowledged a couple of perhaps disparities or differences. He said, for example, he could not confirm that al-Baghdadi was crying or whimpering in his last moments, the way that President Trump described. There may be in these cases discomfort from government agencies about speaking after the president speaks, because you're going to be asked to verify all of what he's just said.
Rukmini, you're an expert in this space. What were your thoughts on what the president said in that press conference in terms of the veracity, but also just how he presented this information to the American public?
Well, back to the box that Brian described that the president finds himself in, I would add that in addition to the impeachment inquiry, the other context that's happening here is that this announcement is happening on the heels of the catastrophic decisions that the president has made in northeastern Syria regarding the betrayal of an American ally, the Kurds, an area that used to be somewhat stable in northeastern Syria that was being held down by an American ally has been thrown into chaos by the president's decision. So I think that's part of the context here, and trying to put a positive spin on a situation that is pretty negative. Regarding the veracity of what he said, I know that he is most likely not telling the truth about one specific thing. In the press conference, the president said that they knew of Baghdadi's whereabouts as of a couple of weeks ago. I know for a fact that they knew his whereabouts in at least July. I was contacted by sources at that point in time who said to me that they knew where he was and that a mission was being put into motion. Regarding the whimpering, you know, God knows, it seems far-fetched to me that if a terrorist leader is hiding in a tunnel, and this is a group of people that we know use explosives and suicide belts, it seems far-fetched to me to think that American forces would be so close to him that they would hear him crying or whimpering.
Rukmini, do we see this as the potential for an ISIS recruitment tool, the death of al-Baghdadi here? Is there some sort of, or do we expect some sort of retaliation from ISIS or what remains of ISIS right now?
I think that first of all, just like the death of bin Laden led to revenge attacks, we expect that we will see the same with Baghdadi. But I have to say that in the hours since the announcement, ISIS channels that I'm monitoring on the app Telegram have been relatively muted. There's not a lot of chatter. Now, this could be that the group is just in shock and is trying to decide what to make of this. It could be that they themselves have not confirmed his death. But I was expecting something more, and so far I haven't seen that.
Rukmini Kalamaki is the terrorism correspondent for The New York Times. Rukmini, thanks for being with us.
It's my pleasure. Take care.
Brian, lots to talk about. You've been tweeting about this and about other journalists who may have known about the raid and were waiting to report on it. What lessons should journalists be taking away from how to report on this right now?
Yeah, in the era of enemy of the people rhetoric, I think it's worth noting what happened behind the scenes on Saturday when James Laporta of Newsweek and other journalists were aware that a raid was unfolding, a raid that was targeting al-Baghdadi, but chose not to report it for at least several hours until U.S. forces were out of harm's way. Now, these are pretty common choices that are made in these situations. These choices have been made for decades by news organizations. But in this era where the president is demonizing the media, I think it's worth noting when there are those kinds of daily patriotic acts by journalists. And of course, you know, the other layer of this is the verification element. It took hours to have it confirmed that al-Baghdadi was the target and that he was killed in this raid. You know, and President Trump's teaser was so interesting, the way he came out and said something very big just happened, but waited 12 hours to tell us what. You know, in a different circumstance, that would be very troubling. For example, if the U.S. stock markets had been open, I wonder what the reactions would have been.
Also, the president, what I thought was really interesting was how he said, you know, it felt like he was in a movie watching this unfold in the Situation Room. And a lot of the descriptions, a lot of the language he used also sounded like he was describing a movie, not an actual raid of this significance. I mean, yes. What do you take away from that?
He mentioned more than once, he said, quote, "I got to watch," that he was able to watch this raid unfold. Presumably that's through aerial drones or other aerial imagery. The indication from the New York Times overnight is that there was no live feed from a body camera, that yes, these special forces units do wear body cameras, but they bring the video back for it to be digested later. So if the president was able to watch in a drone sort of video feed, he was able to see some detail, but not perhaps the gruesome detail that he was later describing. He may have been briefed on that later. It does strike me, Tanzina, that on the same week when the new Call of Duty video game comes out, this is the new edition of the video game. It's called Modern Warfare. It actually includes events like suicide bombings and others. It's described as a more mature version of a war video game. The developers talked about how the players of these games have lived in an environment of endless war, and so these games have had to grow up. That, unfortunately, the game and movie version of war has been merging with actual war in terms of how it is perceived and viewed. And that does a disservice to members of the military that are actually living this every day. And of course, now the president's saying he might want to put out some of the video of the raid. And of course, that may be his prerogative, but I do wonder if that would be in the best interest of people or not. After all, it was ISIS propaganda videos of journalists and other Americans being killed that provided fuel to the ISIS fire 5 years ago.
There's also the question of government, you know, sensitivity here to, you know, the classified documents and information and what the American public should and shouldn't see. I want to turn a little bit to what the reaction has been in the media. We saw Nate Silver tweeted, of 538, tweeted that, you know, essentially, and I'm paraphrasing here, but about the quote-unquote, the libs not giving Trump a pass for a good day. I mean, is is it, you know, anyone's job to give the president a pass, or is it just a question of reporting what is happening right now? I mean, I was pretty surprised by that.
I think we have two things going on at once. There are a lot of journalists just trying to find out what actually happened and how significant this will be to terrorism going forward. And then there are partisans on the left and right that are making hay of this story. Certainly there are some Democrats or some anti-Trump voices who barely wanted to give the president any credit for this and said this is really a credit to the armed forces, which of course is true. You should give the most credit to the people on the tip of the spear, regardless of who's in office, regardless of whether it's a Democrat or a Republican. I think what we're going to see today is we're going to see this backlash to the backlash, where pro-Trump voices are going to say you're not giving the president enough credit, or the media is not giving the president enough credit. You know, these are the most boring, predictable sorts of fights that happen in partisan media, where tribes show their allegiances. And I find it personally very tiresome. You know, I thought that the president going to Nationals Park and being booed by thousands of people on Sunday night was revealing about where we are right now. The president was in a little bit of a safe space with a bunch of Republican Congress representatives. He was in a luxury suite at Nationals Park. He was being cheered by his fans there inside the suite. But then all throughout the rest of the stadium, you had this booing. And I think it was perhaps a good thing for the president to be out there in public, to be reminded that not everybody is on his side. He rarely is in those environments, because he's watching Fox, he's hearing from his fans, and he's meeting with his supporters.
And this wasn't a rally.
The president likes to do rallies
where he can control the crowd, where he knows the crowd is going to be supportive. This was a public event. And that happened really on the heels of what some people are saying, you know, this military action might have been his ace. I mean, you know, he's under impeachment inquiry. This was the big draw, and he still got booed.
Yeah, and I think that is... I'm curious. First of all, I'm curious to see how he reacts. Second, I'm curious about the reactions where people were chanting "lock him up," and whether it's ever appropriate to be chanting "lock someone up" about a political official. Of course, the counter to that is if the politician has committed crimes, then lock him up. So there's that debate that we're going to have this meta conversation today about that. But to Nate Silver's point, certainly there are some folks who do not want to give Trump an inch. I think that's always been true in our politics, but it's so much more true now because the country is so much more polarized. And I always think back to the approval rating chart. If you graph the president's approval rating for the past almost 3 years, it looks like we've been in a really boring news environment. It looks like nothing's happened.
Oh, my God.
Right? Because we've only gone from about, 45 to 35. He lives in this zone and never really rises or falls more than a couple of points. You would think nothing interesting has happened.
Well,
it just speaks to how hardened the opinions are. And that is why I do not think that even the news about al-Baghdadi will change the president's standing.
I agree. And I wonder, let's talk a little bit about what we do here, because we, the media, tend to be criticized a lot for moving on too quickly. Is the media is this going to distract the media from other controversies, i.e. the impeachment inquiry and beyond? Or are we going to be able to do multiple things at once?
I think there are outstanding questions about the future of ISIS and about what exactly the significance of this raid was. And those will play out in the days to come. But I think even in the wake of the bin Laden killing, it did not have a measurable impact on President Obama's standing for more than a few weeks. And that was in a slightly less polarized environment. I think there are interesting comparisons to be made today to the Clinton impeachment. Because in the early days of the Clinton impeachment, he ordered airstrikes on bin Laden, attempting to take out bin Laden. And that did not improve Clinton's standing very well either. The impeachment inquiry ultimately is still the biggest story in the political world right now. And that picture darkens every day for President Trump.
Brian Stelter, host of Reliable Sources, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Last week, a historic climate change lawsuit began against ExxonMobil in New York. The oil giant is accused of misleading investors and the public about how climate change regulations would affect its operations. This is also the first major climate change lawsuit to reach trial in the United States. Letitia James, the New York Attorney General whose office brought the case, alleges the fraud cost investors as much as $1.6 billion. Here to break it all down for us is Nicholas Kuznets, a reporter for Inside Climate News. Nicholas, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi.
So Exxon is being accused of what fraud exactly? What did they do wrong?
So Exxon is accused of essentially using two sets of books to assess the risks that the company faces, from regulations to limit global warming emissions down the line.
When you say they keep books, what are they keeping books on? How much what is costing who?
When governments have started and presumably increase their efforts to limit emissions, this will have the effect of basically making companies, consumers, have to pay for carbon emissions. And so the company has been, and many other oil and gas companies and companies in all sorts of sectors, use basically a cost of carbon estimate to try to get a sense of how that will impact their books.
Mm. So we reached out to Exxon, and they told us that because there's no universally accepted cost of carbon, right, that using two different records for accounting is not an issue.
Well, the Attorney General has maintained we're not trying to tell Exxon how to run its business. And the issue here is not whether they used one or two sets of books, which Exxon does not dispute, or even specifically how they estimated what carbon would cost in the future. The issue is all about whether or not investors were deceived, whether they were straightforward with the public and investors about what they were doing.
So you were inside the courtroom last week. What's been happening so far?
Opening statements were early last week, and the courtroom was packed at that point. The case so far has been, as was expected, a kind of very meticulous, even dry accounting of what specifically, not just what the company was doing, but then also the reports to the public, to investors, meetings with investors, what exactly was said, what presentations said that were given during those meetings. So it's very step-by-step, dry recounting of what happened.
So is there a way to sort of understand, for someone like me who's not an accountant, if I were an Exxon stakeholder here, and I am investing in the company or expecting to get some sort of a return on my investment, if Exxon is saying, well, carbon emissions are going to cost, I don't know, $10 per emission, but they don't tell me that, how do you explain what is really at issue here?
Sure. And one thing, just to set that up, too, is it's important to note that this is not just about Wall Street investors. Exxon stock is one of the most widely held in the country. I mean, basically, if you have a 401k or a pension, if you're a teacher or firefighter, you likely own some Exxon stock. More than half of the majority of the company's stock is held by these large institutional investors. What the attorney general is alleging is that investors were led to believe the company was taking a look at its investments, things like long-term projects in Canada's oil sands, which are a relatively dirty form of oil. They're very expensive to produce. That Exxon was looking at these investments and saying, look, even if governments impose steep regulations, this is still going to be a good investment. In fact, what some of the evidence that the attorney general has turned up shows is that if the company were to apply those same assessments, you know, assuming these steep regulations, these investments would not be so wise.
So, Nicholas, a name that we haven't heard in a while, former U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson is expected to testify here. What's his role? Remind us.
So Rex Tillerson was chief executive of Exxon during the period of question in this trial. And the attorney general has turned up evidence showing that Tillerson knew about and approved of the practices that are, you know, being tried here. And so I think what the attorney general is trying to do is to show that this went all the way to the top of the company, that top management approved of what was going on and knew about what was going on.
This is, as we mentioned, the first major climate change case to go to trial in the United States. Nicholas, you covered this space. I mean, how significant is that? And what does that tell us about the potential for more trials in the future?
I think it's a big deal. The public, local and state governments, activist groups are increasingly turning to the courts to help address climate change and the impacts from climate change. Congress and the executive branch have really been failing to do anything about this, haven't been setting the country on a track to limit emissions, and also have not been trying to figure out who is going to pay for all of these huge impacts that we're already beginning to face, increased flooding, worsening wildfires. So increasingly, local and state governments and the public are turning to the courts to step in to try to address this question. There's more than a dozen lawsuits now pending against Exxon and other major fossil fuel companies, trying to get them to help pay the costs. So of all of these, this is the first to go to court, and there's no doubt that what happens in this suit will be cited in all of those that come.
You mentioned Congress, and I want to play a clip here from New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who questioned former Exxon scientists at a congressional hearing last week. Let's take a listen.
1982, 7 years before I was even born, Exxon accurately predicted that by this year, 2019, the Earth would hit a carbon dioxide concentration of 415 parts per million and a temperature increase of 1 degree Celsius. Dr. Hoffert, is that correct?
We were excellent scientists.
How does the company's relationship with the public play into the case? And how do you assess that back and forth there between Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Exxon scientists?
She was referring to some of the work that the company funded into climate science back in the 70s. My organization, Inside Climate News, as well as the Los Angeles Times, published a series of stories back in 2015 that was revealing a lot of that work. The attorney general's investigation actually began just after those were published. But I think that that's an important backdrop. Even though the kind of details that the trial's about are a little different, it comes back to the company's record on climate change and its public record and what they see as a record of denial, not being forthright with the public about what the company knows and what the company is doing.
Nicholas Kuznets is a reporter for Inside Climate News. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Next month, Disney is set to launch its new streaming service, Disney Plus, and audiences will gain access to an extensive range of the studio's films, from classics like Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs to lesser-known releases like 1995's Operation Dumbo Drop. But one controversial title will remain locked away in the Disney vault, 1946's Song of the South. Set on a plantation in the late 19th century, the film was boycotted by the NAACP at the time of its release for selling a whitewashed version of slavery. And while Song of the South has been unavailable to the public for decades, Disney has continued to profit off the property, including the song Zippity Doodah on music compilations and using the film as the basis for the Splash Mountain ride at Disneyland. Joining me now to discuss the film and its legacy is Aramide Tinubu, entertainment editor for Stylecaster.com and film critic. Welcome to The Takeaway, Aramide.
Hi, Tansy. How are you?
So good to have you here. Song of the South has not been an official release in decades, but you watched the film when you were in school. What was it actually about? Tell us a little bit about it.
It's a kind of a strange children's film. It's about a little boy who goes to visit his grandparents at their plantation. His parents are getting divorced, and he meets one of the slaves or former slaves, and he begins telling him these stories about Br'er Rabbit and Br'er Fox. And it's basically about this magical world inside this man's head that the little boy becomes privy to.
Now, it's been accused of sanitizing slavery. You agree?
Definitely. It's definitely about a more idyllic South. It's about these happy and docile slaves at the time. It's really odd because there's no mention of work or anything of that nature, but these are Black people. You see Hattie McDaniel as Mammy, James Bassett as Uncle Remus on this plantation.
When it was released in the 1940s, the NAACP called to boycott the film. Tell us more about that.
Definitely. So if you think about the 40s, the late 40s, mid to late 40s, it's right after World War II. All of these Black people, Black soldiers are coming back from the war, but they're entering a country that is still really segregated, still very racist. There's a ton of lynching going on at the time. And to sort of set us back and say that, well, slavery was this picturesque thing, nothing bad happened, is very problematic.
I think also something that we forget here in the United States is that a lot of the cartoons and the imagery that came from that era was quite racist.
Definitely. It's really upsetting if you think about sort of all of the things that got shuttled through even up until, I would say, the 90s, all of these different images that were put out to children at the time. But I think people really thought and still think, unfortunately, of people of color in this way. So it's perpetuated throughout our popular culture.
I mean, not to go too far off of Disney, but I think Looney Tunes and company had a lot of also, you know, Southern and racist imagery. And Walt Disney himself was not exactly the most sanitized person himself. I want to bring it back here to a second. In 2011 shareholder meeting, Bob Iger was asked if Disney had plans to re-release Song of the South. Let's take a listen to what he had to say.
It was made at a different time. Admittedly, you could use that as context, but I just felt that there are elements to the film, while it was a relatively good film, that wouldn't necessarily sit right or feel right to a number of people today. And just felt that it wouldn't be in the best interest of our shareholders to bring it back. Even though there'd be some financial gain, sometimes you make sacrifices on the financial side to do what you believe is right, and that's an example of that.
So is he making a decision to what to do is to do the right thing, Aramide, or to do the right financial thing there, or both? I mean, what is Bob actually saying?
I think he's doing the easy thing for him. And I think obviously they're still profiting off of the film in terms of Splash Mountain. No one's going to rip down that ride. A Zippity Doodah is still a very beloved and well-known song. I think what would be better would be to provide some context about the film, to put it on Disney Plus with commentary, with history, to allow children and older generations to really unpack what was happening at the time and why this film was made.
When we think about, as we mentioned earlier, there are other Disney films from the 20th century that contain racist scenes, racist characters. How does Disney approach some of those other films on its streaming service? I mean, because it's not just this one. This one is pretty egregious, but there are others.
For sure. I know for certain that they're removing a certain scene from Dumbo. There's a crow there called Jim Crow, so they're just deleting that, which I think is obviously much easier than not having Dumbo on the platform. But there's other films, you know, Peter Pan has some issues. Pocahontas certainly has issues. Fantasia, that looks like they're just going to keep them on the streaming platform as they are. So it's really kind of nitpicking and seeing what they can do and what will work and what won't work for a 21st century audience.
Jim Crow, the crow, is pretty egregious.
Yes.
In addition to everything else that we're talking about. Is it a question? I mean, you're saying that Song of the South could be released if it had context. Do you think they should make the decision to delete the scene and act like it never existed, or keep the scene and provide context for these other films that you mentioned, like Pocahontas and Fantasia, et cetera?
I think what's interesting about Song of the South specifically is that it is set in the antebellum period or just after during Reconstruction. To delete, it'd be much easier to delete the Jim Crow scene from Dumbo because it doesn't really give that much context to the film. The other sort of elements in Peter Pan and Fantasia are odd, a little bit standout-ish. So I think that if they put context behind them, that would also be extremely helpful for new audiences, even if it was something after the film that showed or a pop-up during the playing of the film. I think there's definitely several options that they could do, but they're choosing not to do that.
Has Disney learned any lessons in its decades and decades of creating cartoons about race and about racism, would you say?
I think they're definitely pushing things forward. I think they've learned a lot more about women than they've learned about race. So we get to see something like Brave or something like Tangled sort of remove this princess-esque sort of trope that they've laid on women for so long. Race is still a little bit prickly, and I think they are having, I'm going to give them, you know, props. They are trying to move forward, but I don't think they're quite where they need to be just yet.
Where do they need to be in your estimation? Because they've got the money to be there.
For sure. I think the country as a whole is very behind when it comes to race and racism. And it's something like Song of the South, when we pretend that things like this did not happen or that they didn't exist, that's what becomes problematic. We're not addressing the core of the issue. We're sort of trying to sweep over it or move past it quickly. So I think sort of going back to the root of the issue and looking back at the history is what's important.
Is it enough to take characters and create characters that happen to be of color? Or does Disney have to, and I don't want to just put Disney on the hook. I mean, a lot of media companies, including, as we mentioned, Warner Brothers, et cetera, have had really serious racist imagery. Is it enough to create content that have characters of color in the lead? Or do we have to do more?
We have to do so much more. We have to look at people's culture, their background, where they come from, their understandings of the world. It has to go to the root of who people are, where they've begun, how they approach the world and how they see things.
Do we not give children enough credit for understanding why some older films are offensive? Do we sort of assume, or I guess is Disney in this case, assuming that, you know, they just couldn't deal with it or handle it or their parents couldn't handle it?
Certainly. I think children see much more than we give them credit for, much more.
And how do you make the fact, do you think, you said no one's going to go and tear down Splash Mountain, but Song of the South and it's zippity-doo-dah, do you think there's ever going to be a pullback there?
I don't think so. I think that people are sort of letting it float along, but I do think, like I said, it's very important for us to understand why this film was made and what was going on at the time.
Aramide Tinubu is an entertainment editor for Stylecaster.com and a film critic. Thank you, Aramide.
Thank you so much.
And that's our show for today. If you have any thoughts for us, you can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can reach us on Twitter at The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and thanks so much for listening.